Make sure everybody signs it. So what we're going to finish up Yoredeya, we're going to do hopefully today, and we'll see on Wednesday exactly how we're working, going over the test. This is, I'd rather finish up and go over the test on the non culture class time. Push ahead. But certainly I'm making comments on your test, so you'll see what's missing and what was good and etc. The definition of death topic, which we're going to start today, hopefully will take us no more than today, Wednesday, and maybe Monday. Maybe. Depends how excited we get about it. It's going to be really the meat and potatoes. We're going to get into all the controversies that exist, try to understand what all the arguing is about, debating is about, and talk in a realistic way how heart transplantation takes place. Because what I've noticed in general discussions of this issue, especially about receiving a transplant, is most people have no clue how it really works. And that affects, as nafkamin as halacha, depending on how the system works. So we'll see that. After we finish the various perspectives on death and definition of death in halacha, then we should do the end of life issues, goses and euthanasia, and all those really important lemaisa, unfortunately, even for non-doctors, the mice issues. And then I was thinking the Rarapa Yarapa I might skip. I might not do that just so that we can maybe get started with the Yarachan. But we'll see. Because that's not going to be a very practical, it's a very, you know, sort of hashkafic discussion. The Rarapa Yarapa. I don't know if so, we'll take a vote.
Did it online from Gross or not?
Huh?
Did you do it with Gross?
I did a version of it, an earlier version, but I changed in my thinking a little. So there's an updated version, but we'll see. There was an earlier version of that on the Gross.
You have one over your bio, by the way.
Oh, my bio. Boring. Okay, yeah, we have to do that. We'll do it today. Hang on. There is the preliminary handout I forgot to give you. Which consists of three separate pages, unfortunately. Stapler was not working in the copy. Yes?
Thank you.
I wanted to focus on a comment on Rabbi Tendler. It's in here.
Just be free. Mm-hmm. Well, if he listens to me, you might want to respond. Lost.
Could be very fun. A lot of fun. If there ever was an issue that is a sensitive issue, whatever to him is there. He's taken a lot of resources. So I'm going to do my best to contribute to it.
Have you seen the experimental video? He did the whole thing with the first time.
And now just one more little handout, and then I think I'll stop with handouts for a little while. But this should cover us for the next three sessions. And then there's this.
Even if we don't do what you're doing, would you still have a handout for that stuff?
Yes.
Would you mind giving them that?
Of course.
Just if you had to.
But I mean, if you want to do it, I'm happy to do it. Depends. Is everyone coming back next semester?
Yeah.
Because my concern is I want to make the Orachayim stuff is a lot of practically important issues.
I just want to be
just
able to
make sure that we get to at least some of the most important.
Yeah. So, I said I just want to be able to compile everything at the end, just like a booklet of sorts.
All right. So what are these little three preliminary handouts? What am I after with that? That's the question. I have an agenda. The agenda is to analyze the following statement of Rabbi Tendler. If you look, he has actually, you know, orally made the statement, but he has it in writing here, which is always better than claiming you heard someone say something and somebody's thrown into doubt. He says the following. He's talking in one of his major essays on this topic, and everyone knows the background, I'm assuming, that there's a major heated debate as to the definition of death in halacha with such significant nafkaminas as when you take a person off a respirator and when you take out their heart. And there's strong disagreement as to exactly what the definition of death is, that, you know, you see the players in the discussion, you know, coming out very strong statements. So Rotella makes the following statement. He says, in this context, I would say that the view held by some who oppose brain death criteria, that the concept of death is entirely extraneous to the practice of medicine, is a factual and particularly a halachic error. No less an authority than the Rambam himself stated that all factors concerning death are determined by what the doctors will tell him. So what is Rabbi Tendler emphasizing here? He's emphasizing something that I think is not so simple, and context for this statement is very, very important. He's saying that when it comes to the definition of death, there are some that don't like for us to throw in, and I'm one of them, by the way, a purely medical definition. In other words, there might be a Harvard criteria that had some of the greatest minds in medicine get together and come up with what they're calling the accepted legal definition of death. Legal, and then it's not murder to take this person off the respirator, it's not murder to take their heart out. Right? But I would say that this question of the definition of death, apidin, is not a question for the doctors. It is a question for the poskim. It's a metaphysical question. And Rabbi Tendler is intimating that that's not necessarily true. And the proof that he's bringing is a statement of the Rambam. The Rambam, in a certain context, which you're about to see, said that when it comes to trefos, let me give you the context. This is the Rambam. The Rambam is talking about defining when it comes to a chiyuv misa for killing somebody, right? If somebody kills another person, what's the penalty? Execution, right? With Hasra, the whole deal, you know, right, the person should be the Titus. When is that not true? We talked about this, we did this in the sugya with the Kulin, right? If the murdered individual was a trefa, meaning he was going to die within a year, right? Then you're not going to be chayav misa for killing him, right? You did a bad thing, you may be a chayav misa de shamayim, but you will not be the onish of execution. So the question comes up, so how do we define what a trefa is? How do we define what type of injuries inside the body make somebody into a trefa? So we know that when it comes to kashrus by animals, the Mishnah delineates 18 types of injuries that constitute a trefa by a behemoth. So do we use that? Are we going to use the same list by animals that apply to humans? So the Rambam says no. The Rambam says what's going to determine what a trefa is going to depend on the medicine of that period. In every period, every generation, whatever the doctors tell you, this is a viable lesion. And it means that with a cure, meaning that even medical science can't save this person, right? Then they're a trefa. But if the doctors say, oh, we can save it, or this never will cause death within a year, then it's not a trefa. But it's up to the doctors. So Rabbi Tendler wants to borrow that Rambam statement in that context, and apply it to our context. And I don't think it's fully legit. I don't think Rambam's saying it over there, and he means it. But in our context, that is not the mahalach. I don't think the Rambam would take it, I don't think anyone would take it.
Does that mean that it wouldn't be considered a trade if there's an issue, if it's incurable, but it's he will die within 3 years?
Correct. It's not a trade.
Okay. And my second
within 12 months.
My question is, like, as much as wouldn't the doctor know best when this person is not to be brought back anymore?
Like, it's good. So it is true. If you ask, it's interesting. It's a famous quote. The head of the commission, the Harvard committee that determined brain death, he was a real scientist, but he made the following statement, which goes to what you just said. He said, by the way, we're not defining death. All we're telling you is a state of being where we know the person's not coming. Just the way you put it, which is very careful and very interesting that you put it that way. Shouldn't the doctors be the ones to tell us when a person's dead? You didn't say that, but you instead said something that's very interesting. Is there a reason to do that, by the way? Why didn't you just make a simple statement? You should have just said, shouldn't the doctors, aren't they the best qualified to tell us when a person's dead? Instead you said, the doctors are the best qualified to tell me when a person's not coming back. you didn't realize how true and exact what you were saying is, but it was 100% correct what you said. And that's what the Harvard Committee itself admitted to. We're not defining death. We're just telling you a certain set of physiological parameters that will indicate this person's not coming back. What's the
that
difference?
That could be a statement.
Am I playing?
We're not,
is this semantics? Is there a difference?
You could actually
might not
make
it as a soul or whatever.
Yeah! What about that? What about that old thing? A neshama. When does the neshama leave the body? The doctor's going to tell me that. The doctor knows. Where do we draw the line on that? Because I can tell you, there's something called...
Maybe the neshama makes it awareness.
They certainly wouldn't, and they admitted they don't. That's a metaphysical question. What's metaphysical as opposed to physical or noumenal as opposed to phenomenal? It means there are certain things within our ability to assess with our five senses. The material world we can assess. And then there are things that are in the other world. When the neshama leaves the body, it's a metaphysical question. It's not up to the doctors. However, what are we to do?
That might be
we don't. We're not nevi'im. We can't like know that moment, can we? So what do we usually do when we're faced with this type of problem? Where do we get the answer to this?
Torah.
What?
Torah.
Right. We look to the Torah. Toshma. And then we have a system.
We don't know when the
halachic process.
We don't know when the neshama leaves. It doesn't tell us.
Well, hold on. That's what this is all about. Because the whole.
Because
the
if the neshama is locked in this body that is not going to be able to come back in it, then better to just let the neshama go and like discharge the patient.
You're going to say, that's interesting, because that's a ghosis. Right? What you're saying is the way some people look at ghosis. Ghosis is somebody where, it's even worse than ghosis. That is when we do euthanasia, we're going to see a robot, very famous robot, who says that if you have a person who is dying, or a ghost is, and beyond the ghost is, and the only thing keeping him alive is the wood chopper making this noise, you'd rather tell the wood chopper to stop. Aren't you causing the death of this guy, right, by doing that? No, that's just hasaras hamoneh. You're just taking away the impediment to death, which he means exactly what you just said. He means that's a situation where, look, the neshama wants out. This neshama is already.
What is that? That's a wood chopper.
Yeah, we'll see. That's the next topic. We'll see. You know, in the times of the robot, there was a wood chopper outside the window of the chol chop, making a noise, right? Or there was salt on his tongue. You'll see there's other examples of things that they consider to be sort of just holding back the neshama, but this is a very tricky area. Very tricky area. It's going to really come up when we do euthanasia, we'll do it. But let's step back. I don't want to get that tricky. I don't want to get that tricky. I'm not ready to get that yet. We're going to get this very heavily. But all I want to do now is define death for two other reasons. You know, the truth is, as when we get into this handout, you'll see, death. Defining death was never important in halacha. Really, what are the nafkaminas for death in halacha in the before the 20th century?
When bury them? When you want to call them?
Okay, when you should bury them. When you can say that there's pikuach nefesh, right? Because there's no pikuach nefesh in kliyas space. What else?
Tumah.
Yes. That was the biggie. When does a Kohen have to stay away? Right? So, even the Rabbi Lord Kobitz,
we didn't know. Maybe a Kohen
the
could go visit
founding father of bioethics, right? Ever heard of him? Mm-hmm. He's the man, right? So, he writes about this topic. It's interesting. I'm going to show you. You have it in his hand now. He's writing in the 50s, and then he's writing later. So in the 50s, he's making the point, you know, unlike other religions, you know, other religions of Christianity, there are certain sacraments that must take place at the moment of departure of the soul. So they're very into, their literature is very heavy into defining that moment. But he says, we don't do that, we don't care. Because, you know, what's the nafkamin? The nafkamin is by Kohen, but a Kohen can't go in when there's a ghost sees him, right? We're machmir, we say a Kohen shouldn't go in even while the guy's alive, but he's about to die. So we don't have to be that precise, we're machmir anyway. What's the big nafkamina for us, right? And if there's any suffering, we're always going to try to save their life anyway, right? So then, in the 70s, something changed, and we need to define death. But we'll get to that in a moment, what changed. What I want to get to is, how do we go about defining death? Rabbi Tendler is intimating in this article, you know, to a large degree, let's just ask the doctors. I'm going to say that's inadequate.
That's not
a huh? No, we got a lot to talk about. I picked out this quote because it bothered me. I don't agree with it. And I'm very comfortable in asking. You didn't really need that, did you? So take a look at the Chasam Sofer, over to the right. I'm going to tell you what it says. So I'm not going to play the name of the chorus. What the Chasam Sofer says is like this. He says, he had the same issue. This was that famous case of the Duke from Mecklenburg, right? Everyone know this case? They wanted to say everybody's got to be buried after 72 hours, right? You got to get 3 days, don't bury anyone, right? And Moses Mendelssohn wanted to say, Al-Pidin, we should do the same thing, right? Why? Because there's a brisa in Smachos. It says there was this one guy, and he woke up at his levaya and lived another 20 years, had 15 kids, whatever it is. I've got all the details even ready for that story, but we see that it's possible to make a mistake. We should be careful. Wait till there's like rigor mortis setting in. You know, you need 3 full days, and then we'll ban.
Do they also still?
No. Well, I told you the story of my brother. Can I tell you guys?
What?
Go, go.
You want a story?
Yeah.
Quick
story.
He's
a neurobiologist.
He
not tell us.
Oh, make sure you ask him about it. Whoever's taking his class, he's
a neurobiologist, right?
I don't know, because I told him, I got his permission, I can deliver the story. I said, it's a good break story.
Keep the break.
He was a resident. And ironically, the attendant that was, you know, like whenever you're on service, you have an attendant who's in charge of everything, you know, the senior doctor, and the residents who do all the work, right? That's the great system. They're used to it. One day you'll be an attending, and you'll be on the other side. In the meantime, so this attending had a, I forget if it was his mother or his father, or God, was on the service, sick, was ill in the hospital, was on their service, very ill. And the attending went home, and they had this woman in the middle of the night covered with rest, and they thought, not me. So here they're amateurs. They couldn't get the neurologist. Normally the neurologist is the one who's going to declare death. Like petitioning. Whatever reason, they did it on their own. You know, there was a flat line, they didn't have a pulse, they didn't have a blood pressure. They determined death had occurred. So what do you do when there's death? You put a person in a body bag. Right? Yeah, I never got into life. And you take them down to the morgue. So there they are in the process of, they put this woman in the body bag. And they're about to move over to the gurney and take down to the morgue, and suddenly, did you hear that? And full arrest again, and they go to bed. But before that had happened, guess who they had called already? The attending, a child, this individual. This is like 2 a.m, had him come rushing in. I'm sorry to tell you, things are going to be worse. That's what you always say. You never tell a person on the phone. You say, things are looking bad, they're going to come in. But the doctor knows, usually what that means. So this guy's coming running in, expecting that it was over. In the meantime, they coded again and brought her back. She, I think, lasted like another half a day or so, another day. Can you imagine that? Then you got to come in and tell them, oh, no mistake.
Then you call them again, and
that's not happening.
He's like, ah, it's
true. You know what happens to you? The agonal breathing. Agonal breathing is, I don't know what's on the person, at the very end, the respiratory rate is very, very prolonged. And sometimes they're like just have an imperceptible breathing, which you can't see it. And until they take a big. That, which is what happened. That's what
that
happened. Like they missed the fact that the skills are
already
happening.
That one says already that one.
Anyway,
that's already
not supposed to happen. That's supposed to happen.
What about the pulse though?
So, can I say it never happens?
What about the pulse?
The BT and the pulse.
Imperceptible. You know, in other words, when you have a thready, when you have a very thready pulse, the copy was there was no invasive monitoring. An invasive monitoring would pick things up. And I think they did it through an EKG, because an EKG also would have picked something up.
You could have a hypothermia also.
Oh, yeah, okay, definitely have hypothermia, but there you'll have vital signs, you know, because the person will usually be intubated, and here this was like a DNR, the person is not intubated, the person is not really getting any kind of monitoring, that's crazy. Anyway, it's horrible.
In order for a pulse not to
be... So, ask him about it.
In order for not to feel a pulse in the ground, okay, over here, doesn't the blood pressure have to be under 40?
Yeah. Could be.
So,
could
does
be.
That mean a hit?
When you're dealing with... No. That's what we're trying to figure out. What does it mean when you're dead? That is not the definition. If that were the definition, we'd all be committing murder left and right. I better not be the name. All right. So, Chassam Sofer says, forget this whole Duke of Mecklenburg edict. Forget Moses Mendelssohn. We're not doing things that way. You don't follow what the doctors in the times are saying. We have to go with Chazal. Chazal will define death for us. And he says, you know how Chazal are going to do it? They're going to do it one of three ways. Either they're going to have a halacha l'moshe b'sina. They're going to have a masorah where the definition of death was given. Or two, there'll be a pasuk. They'll be able to be dorish the pasuk. Or three, they will ask the experts of their time. That is a possibility. But it has to be Chazal that did it. And once Chazal determines what that definition of death is,
even if it's based on Zion, this is
So, at least according to Chazon Ish, and to, and I'm going to skip, I'm not going to go through, but Moshe has a tshuva that relates to this, Chazon Ish does it, turn to the next page, and the Steigler, all of them talk about it. What I want you to see is Rav Shechter, someone near Dionysus, right? Rav Shechter on the bottom weighs in on this issue, and I think he diametrically opposes Rav
Shechter.
Page 2, right, where it says, the Ikve Atzomer, Rav Shechter basically says over here, is exactly what I'm driving at, which is, you cannot assume that the definition of death could come from something that the doctors are going to tell us alone, but it has to be through Chazal. Whatever Chazal determines the definition of death, and he quotes the Chazon Ish, who says that once that's determined, no matter what happens, that will be the definition of death, right? There are other posts that don't agree. I'll tell you this. There are other posts that say that it could change. It could change. But in this area, we will, we've not had any, you can't change it in cool. You can change it in the chum. In other words, because if Chazal tell me I need a certain amount of threshold to meet before I declare this person dead, I can't have medical science tell me in some generation, oh, you don't really need to do that. You can get away with less. I could have medical science change it the other direction. You know, you thought that was death, but it's really not. So we will accept the change. Those poskim that do it, by the way, not all poskim do it. The Chazon Ish does not. Steipler does only under certain conditions, and Moshe was the most liberal in this area, actually, allowing for some change of halacha based on changes in medical science, but never he would never do it along the lines of the kula lagabe declaration of death. It's too much of a suffix, right? You're really not sure. The dead, so you can't just say because medical science told me that Chazal was being too rigid that we have a new definition. Because they don't know the metaphysical truth better than Chazal. Chazal has a better insight into the metaphysics than the contemporary greatest doctors in the world.
So basically, the few places that I've seen in Chazal, basically, it all seems to say that they're talking about the physical aspect of death. And in addition to that, we see a few times in Chazal where they actually omit anything that they don't like. If, let's say, there's another Tana Amar that says something that they didn't like, they did not mention. They mentioned him, they didn't mention his view.
Who's the dead? Actually, you know what? This is like a topic that you and I should have privately. Meaning, it's going to take us off topic. It's a whole discussion. So I'm not running away from it. You know, like I'm very happy to talk about it, but I will never get through this. So I'll have it after. We'll talk about it. Let's focus on the topic again. So the bottom line is, at the end of the day, what I'm getting at is that we need to find out what Chazal's definition of that, and that really is the way to define. Right? And the truth is, Rabbi Tendler himself does that. Right? Even though he made that little statement, I'm taking it out of context, he himself will substantiate his view based on the Makoros. We just have to see how everybody learns the Makoros. Before we do that, I want everybody to open up. That third sheet I gave you now is just a point of reference for the contemporary relevance of all this, which is that in the Knesset last year, they came out with this, it's almost like a year and a half ago, they came out with this little law where they're going to be determining death, and they're going to use a whole committee to do it. What impressed me is they were following Rabbi Tendler's approach. They were letting the doctors have the biggest sway in it, seems to me, not following the Rabbanim, which again is not the way to go. Not the way to go. And really, all the ones that discuss this topic, from Rabbi Tendler to Rabbi Gleich, to the Rabbanot, to Rav Moshe, to Rav Shlomo Zalman, to Rav Elash, Rav Yashav, all these people, we're going to talk about what they say. They all look at the Makaris that we're going to be looking at. Okay? Before we do that, though, I want to quickly run through some of the interesting parts of this handout. So page 1. Page 1 on top is that little piece from Rabbi Jacobowitz's book, where he tells you this thing I told you before. In the 50s, you weren't really interested. But then things changed. On the bottom is this 75, the new edition. There you already mentioned the two reasons. What are the two main reasons suddenly that the definition of death became important? The things we said earlier: heart transplants and liver transplants, and the problem in ICUs with too many people sitting around on ventilators and we're stuck. Right? And we need to kill them, excuse me, we need to declare them dead in order to remove them from the rest of it. Right? So those are the compelling reasons. That's what caused the Harvard Committee to come up with their definition. There was a classic definition of death: cessation of breathing and cessation of heartbeat. It wasn't until these two compelling needs came in that we suddenly needed to redefine worship. In their view, they'll say that I'm being very unfair. So I will try not to be unfair. I'll say we needed to sharpen our definition, hone in on a more precise definition.
Would the Harvard Law turn that into a new religion?
Nothing to do with
it. So, like, it has to be a new religion.
That's what I'm saying.
But, like, how do they define it?
They're saying that, first of all, they don't believe in religion.
Well,
the divisions, I don't know if they did it. In other words, when medical science is more important than the legal community is the ones that demand this, right? The medicine was like takes a more passive approach to these issues sometimes. You kind of back off, leave alone. But you're forced to by the courts. Because the courts need it. Because the courts got to know who to charge with what, who to sue, who to do what. So we need strict definitions. So they got this committee together and said, look, you got to define in absolute terms what death is going to be, and then that would be our legal definition, and we take it from here, and now we can start taking people's hearts out and start doing different things. So it's not, and there, you know, there's no religious input into that. In the Rabbanut, in Eretz Yisrael, in fairness to the Knesset, what they did is they threw some rabbis on, and were interested in what the Rabbanut had to say, and it wasn't going to be the sole arbiter. In the ideal theocracy that Yahadus was meant to be, of course it would be the Sanhedrin deciding what the definition of death is. They might need some medical experts, we'll see. Certainly medical experts should be inputting into the decision, right? But the psak, the final word, is the halacha. Okay, so turn to page. Let's do a little biology, because we have to do a little biology. So if we skip, all the beginning is sort of like background as to why this became important. Turn to page 4. Page 4 is the landmark article on the diagnosis of brain death. So I want to do this with you guys. We are all going to learn now how to declare somebody brain dead. Something you always wanted to know, but maybe you were too shy to ask. So this article, if you want to read it in your, you know, in your free time, basically goes through the process, the history, and how it works. But turn to page 5. That's where the interesting parts begin. All right? Everybody sees there a brain. Everyone has to have at least a layman's working knowledge of how the brain works. So we're gonna do this. When I did this with the Smicha guys, they were like not as enthusiastic as I know you guys are gonna be to understand this. Look at the right upper hand corner, we have a brain. Major parts of the brain are the cerebral hemispheres, which takes care of what? What do the cerebral hemispheres do? Anyone know? Anyone take biology here? Who's taking neurobiology next semester? Let's give you a head start. You did it. What does the brain do? What does the cerebral cortex do?
Thanks.
Well, that's one thing it does. So, consciousness, motor, sensory, does a lot, right? You are conscious because of your cerebral cortex. You feel things because of your cerebral cortex. And you're able to move because of your cerebral cortex. All that important stuff. What about the brainstem? What's in the brainstem? Two very important other things.
Breathing. Unconscious thing.
Involuntary.
Yeah. Like breathing, which hopefully we do whether we're conscious or not, right?
I think there's somewhere. I don't know if this is true or not.
Unless we have Undine's curse. Have anyone here heard of Undine's curse? Anyone up on Greek mythology? You either know this because you're a doctor, or you know it because you're into Greek mythology. Or you don't know it.
I guess it controls breathing.
Undine was a it's a Greek myth about someone who got a curse that if he ever fell asleep, he'd stop breathing. That's what the Greek myth is about. The disease is exactly that. It's a horrible disease. I've seen one case. I remember when I was a medical student. Can you imagine?
It's
not a good disease.
Because it's like
there's no cure. And like, what do you do?
What do?
You
can't
you put on a ventilator. Wow. Right? When you're awake, you're okay. So it's only nighttime.
Can't
no naps, no boring classes.
Like
but have a very exciting life. Anyway, so short of that, though, he had this injury to the brainstem that causes them. Now, the brainstem definitely modulates breathing. What else does it have? Does everyone know?
Like heart beat, I remember. Is it true that the brain it does control? Yeah. So I know the heart is independent, but does the brain have an effect on the regulation of the beat, of the way it beats?
Yes. The brainstem also will affect blood pressure and heart rate. It does.
I have a question.
And then there's one other thing that comes out of the brainstem that's very important. Cranial nerves. Anyone who takes neurobiology will learn a lot about cranial nerves. Cranial nerves are nerves that come out of the brainstem, and it's almost like Hashem put them there in order to allow for the things that we're going to be talking about to happen. That's my little foray into hocus pocus. No. It's nerves that will have certain reflexes, right? Again, anything coming out of the brainstem is going to be involuntary to the large degree. So if I touch your cornea, what will you do?
Blink.
If I even blow air into your cornea, what are you going to do? Blink. Why? Because it's two cranial nerves, an afferent and efferent. Does anyone know what those terms mean?
Yeah, two and then
right. Afferent is
approaching.
Right? It's the input. Efferent is the output, which is going to cause something to happen. Right? So let's say for the corneal reflex, so there's that sensation and then there's the action. Two different cranial nerves do it. You don't need to know the cranial nerves. Not for this class. Right? And then let's say I put cold water in your ear. What would happen to you?
Sure.
You would have nystagmus. Do you ever see someone's eyes? There are people that have a condition where their eyes are going like this all the time.
Yeah.
That's called nystagmus. Sometimes nystagmus is normal. Like if I put cold water in your ear. That type of effect would be a normal effect.
Try it.
It's a way to test that cranial nerve. What would happen to you if I took a tongue blade and I put it down your throat?
Gag.
You might throw up on me. Or gag, at least. That's a gag reflex, right? What would happen if I touched over here, applied pressure? Right. Well, you could do that. It would also result in another reflex. All of these are cranial nerve reflexes, which are going to be part of the testing of the brainstem.
Nothing happened.
Right. Alright, I guess we'll have to check you out. So again, what you need to know about the brain is the cerebral cortex is motor, consciousness, and sensory. All voluntary, all reactions. And the brainstem and the spinal cord are reflexes, right? And they're involuntary, and they include breathing, some effects on heart rate and blood pressure, and the cranial nerves. The other thing you need to know is on the bottom. Is the blood supply of the brain. You don't need to know all the details, but one day you will. If you go to medical school or dental school, you definitely have to know. But for now, I just want you to get a feel for the complexity. Take a look at that blood supply. You see what that blood supply looks like? This is going to be a major machlokes, Rabbi Bleich and Rabbi Temple. That gets into this a little. See the way the arteries, those are the carotid arteries over there? They come up and supply the brain, but there's like all sorts of roots. See how complicated it is? Huh? They both know everything that we're talking about backwards and forwards. Don't worry about it. They absolutely do. So how is this good? What does that have to do with declaring death? Well, if I want to declare dead, according to, we'll see how this pans out. Let's just stick with Harvard. Okay? We're going to do totally secular. According to the secular definition of death, there are two possible ways of declaring someone dead. Either cardiorespiratory, like the good old-fashioned way, which means your heart stopped and you're not breathing. That still works. You still have someone dead, right? Or brain death. What does brain death mean? Both cortex and brainstem are out. So how you go about proving that both the cortex and the brainstem are both not functioning? So what's the least helpful thing?
EEG.
It's not helpful. What is an EEG? An EEG, anyone ever seen an EEG? An EEG can be confirmatory. It doesn't really help much, because what EEG measures is sort of the electrical activity at the surface of the cerebral cortex. Right? So let's say you took some bad drugs, and you're in a coma from the barbiturates or something like that, you have a flat EEG. Should we bury you? Probably not, because you'll probably help to come out of it. Right? And also, so drowning, you could also have a flat EEG. It'd be very misleading. So it's confirmatory. Like if you start to see activity, then you begin to wonder what's going on here. right? But a flat one doesn't really help you.
Ah,
MRI.
MRI.
Why will MRI help?
Okay.
Who would think an MRI would be helpful? So, you need to know a little more.
There's no blood flow that could help.
Oh, so we'll see. That's going to be very potentially important, at least according to some
studies.
Right? That there's no blood. If there's no blood flowing to the brain, you think the person's dead?
Yeah.
Very
possible.
No.
Definitely.
What if his heart's beating? Good. Good. So, but let's just deal with brain death. We're not ready for the halakha thing yet. We just want to deal with brain death. So, I would say if somebody could conclusively show there's no blood flow to the brain, that would be a very, very good way to show brain death. That is not typically done. In fact, I have never seen it done.
Why can't you answer?
It could be done. But we'll see there's hidden problems to that. We're going to get into that a lot. Because according to Rabbi Tendler, you need to do that. That was my famous.
I read that they're like, you can give like radioactive like isotopes.
We'll have to talk about how valid those are. But I'll show you one.
I'll show you one.
Let's look at the pictures. The pictures speak a thousand words. So turn the page. Don't talk about Rabbi Tendler.
No, I just didn't hear that.
Right, I'm saying Rabbi Tendler is going
to
say.
We need to
yeah, it's going to be a very important part of his thing. It's going to be very important. You'll see why in a moment. Anyway, on page 6, you have, this is the summary of the Harvard criteria. They say like this. Look at the table. Just focus on the table. You really need two things. You need either cardiopulmonary, like I said, but it's not just that it's not working. You have to show irreversibility. Right? Remember, it's always, you need to show it stopped, irreversible. So how do you show irreversibility? The way that conventional medical science is decided is we go back anywhere between, depending on your hospital, between 6 and 24 hours later, and check it again. If you show that it hasn't come back in 6 to 24 hours, irreversibility. Okay, good. So you got to do that for cardiopulmonary and for neurologic. So what is neurologic? It means cessation of cerebral functions and brainstem functions. Irreversibility is because you, number one, you exclude causes like I told you before. It can't be a drug overdose. It can't be a drowning. Things where it can be faking. It can be fooling you.
And those are all causes where after 24 hours, definitely you would be back again.
No, those would be more than 24 hours. In the case of drowning, or in the case of hypothermia, or in the case of drug overdose, it changes the whole definition. You've already excluded that possibility. Then you have to do 24 hours. Right. So now turn to page 7. Here we have really the modern brain death setup. So remember, cerebral cortex, I told you, is motor, sensory, and consciousness. So the first thing you want to do is show the person is unresponsive, unconscious, does not respond to pain, and can't move, right? So you do, like, if you ever see this, the neurologist comes over, starts screaming, right? The guy conscious, you know? Then he goes to pain, right? He starts pricking, starts doing all sorts of sadistical things, you know?
Well, this is the reflex.
Right. Well, no, that's not going to be helpful in this regard. But that's a reflex. This is, we want conscious effects. We want to know, I'm sticking a needle into your head, does it bother you? And if it doesn't, you're unconscious. It sounds like your cerebral cortex is out, right? Does that mean you're dead? No, you might be in a persistent vegetative state, which is something very different. That's terishiyama, right? What is the difference between a persistent vegetative state and a brain-dead person? They're not the same. Rabbi Tendler thinks, well, a lot of the mistakes the post-human were making is they were confusing these two. But I don't think so. They weren't, because they're very different. A persistent vegetative state means that the only thing that's out is your cerebral cortex. You're unresponsive, you're unconscious, you're not feeling pain, you're not reacting, you're not moving. However, you have your brainstem completely intact. That's called a persistent vegetative state. No one would say you could kill that person, not even Harvard criteria. Those people are alive. The question is, can you starve them to death? That's the bioethical question. That was Terry Schiavo. In other words, what do we do with someone like this? We just let them live? What do we kill them?
The chance of people like that
that's what it seems to be.
But is it impossible for those people ever to come back again?
No, there are reported cases where they do. Not too many. But there are definitely reported cases, and it's a whole Indian we're going to get to at the end of life.
It's more so the people that got back from it.
Two of you talking at the exact same time, I didn't hear either one.
Wasn't
Yeah, there's plenty of cases like that. Just Google it. If you're interested, if you get excited about things like this, so Google declared dead alive or something like that, and you'll get like all these cases. That's how you do it. I once was giving a talk at a place where I thought that the intellectual level was not there, and they just wanted to like fun things. So that's when I did my Google on that topic, because that really turns on an audience to have like cases like that. But for real intellectual purposes, I don't know what it'll do, because it's like 1 in 1,000, 1 in 1 million, 1 in 1 billion. You know? It's like the case of Smachos. Is that going to affect my decision making on declaring someone dead? No. Because that could happen, that wouldn't be the problem. No one takes that approach. Say, oh, you might be wrong. It's not that. It's what's the definition? I'll be dead. What's the definition of death? That's our question. So, again, I want to make sure you understand the difference between persistent vegetative state and brain death. Brain death needs the bottom part out. So how do we get the bottom part out, the brain stem out? So in the middle column, number 2, what do you think that's a diagram of? All those cranial nerves I was telling you about before, right? So the pupils, that's a great, everyone knows about the pupil reflex, right? If I shine light in the pupil, it's going to constrict. Because that's cranial nerves, it's the ophthalmic nerve, right? That's nerves 2 and 3. Excuse me?
It doesn't mean your brain stem's not working, though.
No, it means your brain stem is working.
No, if it doesn't react.
It's necessary to show. In order to show the brainstem, if you're claiming the brainstem is out, you must have negative on all the cranial nerves.
But there are many other ones. I mean, I don't know nerves, but I think
it's
that.
It's so it's but one part of the whole picture, right? These are all components. First thing we did was we took care of the cerebral cortex, right? We pinched him, we talked to him, we gave him pain, and that was number 1. Number 2 is go to the cranial nerves. Number 3 is the biggie. Number 3 is really important. What we haven't checked yet is breathing, right? So we do something called an apnea test. This is the single most important part of the whole thing. The apnea test. According to Eretz Yisrael, the Rabbanut, this is all you need to do, basically. I mean, they say do the rest also, but the key to their shita is the apnea test. They are going to hold al pi din, the definition of death, is permanent cessation of breathing. That's what the apnea test tests. How does it work? What is the reason you are breathing right now? I'm going to make it interesting. Let's say you were asleep. You're asleep. Let's say, Chas v'Shalom, you fell asleep in our class. Can't imagine. What makes you breathe? Say something like your brainstem. Good.
Right, that's what you said before.
But what's the brainstem going on? How does it decide how fast you are?
Levels of carbon dioxide.
Yes, good. You guys learned something, right? Bio?
Let me answer.
What is the purpose of breathing? It's to breathe in oxygen and breathe out carbon dioxide. Good. In the O2, out the CO2, right? So the stimulus for breathing is those two things. If the oxygen is low, right, which usually is not, or if the carbon dioxide, really, that's the real stimulus. The carbon dioxide goes up. If a person's carbon dioxide is allowed to rise, right, what's the normal carbon dioxide, anyone know? 40. So if it's allowed to rise above that and the person doesn't breathe, we can be convinced they failed the apnea test, they had irreversible cessation of breathing. Does it mean they're dead? So, according to the Rabbi Newton, pretty much.
What does it tell me?
What's the problem with that definition?
What does it tell me?
Who would have a positive and negative apnea test, meaning that would fail an apnea test? What disease? Polio.
No,
not
the other
one. Yes, yes.
Only polio?
No, other ones also. The polio would, right? So, are all the people with polio and the iron lungs and things dead? That's for sure. So, obviously, they have to modify their definition. And they say, of course, you're not responsive and you're not awake and talking to me, things like that.
Yeah, that's what the first two cover.
But the essential thing is going to be, right? What?
That's what the first two cover.
Right, pretty much. As long as you've done the whole thing, they say you're covered. But the thing that defines death, according to the Rabbanut, we'll see that also very important for our declaration of brain death, according to the secular Harvard criteria, is cessation of breathing. So you give an apnea test. How do you make sure that it has nothing to do with lack of oxygen? That's,
it's your room.
That you're not going to kill somebody. Let's say they're really alive. They're on a ventilator, right? This is how it happens. The typical scenario that you'll see, ICU, this guy's been sitting on this respirator now 3 weeks, costing taxpayer or whatever hundreds of thousands of dollars. pressure's on, get this guy out of here, you know, one way or the other. What are we gonna do? So, all right, let's give him an apnea test. But what if he's alive? You take him off the vent, you're gonna kill him. So, oh, don't worry, we're gonna give him 100% oxygen, because that's what they did. You give 100% oxygen for whatever amount of time, 15, 20 minutes. They hyperoxygenate him. And now they can safely, let's say, turn off the vent and allow his CO2 to rise, because the vent was making his CO2 normal. It's keeping it down to 40 or below, right? But once we stop the vent, the CO2 will rise unless he breathes on his own. And that's exactly how an apnea test is done, right? It's all detailed in that sheet, but that's basically the bottom line.
What do you mean? Once he gets to 40, then we want to see him start to breathe?
Yeah, he has to make some kind of effort to breathe.
All
I need to see is Andy, I'll put him right back on the vent. But if he doesn't make any efforts, he's dead.
So if he,
but since the break,
if he,
so there are no efforts,
he doesn't breathe. You can't put him back.
Assuming he got through one and two, right, without sedation. The first thing you do, you stop all sedation, right? You get rid of all the drugs, get all the narcotics off, all the benzos, all that stuff, get it out. Now the guy is whoever he is, brain-wise, here he is, right? So you test his responsiveness, his motor activity.
Oh, not working.
Not doing a thing. Do his cranial nerves, nothing. You say, all right, what about his medulla? His medulla oblongata? What is that? Is he breathing? Is he able to breathe? So you do an apnea test. If he fails the apnea test, and then you come back 6 hours and do it again. Send him to the
room. You're allowed to put him back on a respirator after you take him off and do the apnea test?
How long is this? Oh, it depends. No, that'll be the next topic you do, but sometimes no. Sometimes you shouldn't.
Yeah,
100%. Sometimes you shouldn't. We'll see how that works in real life. But just now I'm purposely just focusing on brain death and on death, because it's going to play such a role in that next topic, right? It's going to be part of it also.
But, I mean, the body wants balance in either way.
Slow here.
With the both the O2 and the CO2. So with an increase in O2 automatically, because once you take the vent, wouldn't the body automatically try to raise the CO2? Because I mean, if he has,
it's not an equilibrium between O2 and CO2.
No, but if he has some kind of oxygen, he's not going to breathe. Nothing is going to get.
No. There's the stronger impetus. The two impetuses to breathe, right? Low oxygen will make you breathe faster, right? If you're like drowning or suffocating or whatever, but, you know, or elevated CO2. We're taking the O2 out of it, right? The reason we're doing that is simply because we want to be protecting him somehow, because we're about to stop his ventilation. So we want to give him a buffer. That's all that does. But now, what we're really interested in is what does the level of CO2 do, and does he make any efforts? You know, they'll let it rise up to 60, and the guy's still not breathing, it means he's dead, according to the Harvard criteria. Is there anything that will be in addition to Harvard criteria? So turn the page. This is what you guys are talking about. Look at the top of that page. This is a nuclear scan, right?
What else is going on?
The tender is fine, I'm saying the hole in the head sign. Right? You see image number 30 over there?
Yeah.
So you see there's a body and then a big white space in the head. That's a hole in the head. That's the radiology expression, because it should be all filled in with brain. But the implication of this scan is there's no blood flow to the brain. Right? And that's why it doesn't light up. Wherever there's blood supply will light up. Wherever there's not blood supply won't light up. So this is a brain dead person. That's what this is a picture of, an actual brain dead. Today we even have more sophisticated ways of doing this. If you look at the bottom image, something called a PET scan. Anyone ever hear of a PET scan?
Yeah.
I guarantee you that when you guys, whoever's going into medicine, or in medicine, you're going to be dealing with PET scans. PET scan is looking at metabolic activity in the brain. It's even more sort of sensitive. It can tell you a lot more about what's going on. So some people want to use that. And here I want you to see the difference between the vegetative state, brain death, and a healthy control. So you see the healthy control?
Mm-hmm.
Nice. See the brain dead hole in the head. Nothing's going on over there. There's no metabolic activity. In the vegetative state, there's still metabolic activity. This guy's got some activity. I don't know what it is. It's not conscious, but there's activity going on. So he has some lighting up.
Can you tell the difference?
You see the difference between the last two?
No.
It's total black.
Whoa.
Look at the chart on the side.
The chart on the side. Okay. There's no real difference.
Oh,
it's
zero to two.
You don't appreciate it. I appreciate it. Oh, yours came out terrible.
Yeah.
Sorry. What? Oh, you can't tell from your
picture. No, it's not better than yours.
You can't see a thing.
Oh.
Oh, okay. It's a little bit different.
I'm wondering what's wrong with this guy. Don't go into radiology.
No, it makes more sense.
I should have brought in actual films. This is a poor copy also. The actual film's even more straight.
No,
okay, so why is this important, this last page? This last page is going to be very, very important in our whole issue, because of the machlokes between all these different people. We'll get into the details. But the reliability of these scans is going to be important, and how often it's done. Typically, we do not do this. If you ask for it, you can have it done. One hidden problem in asking for this is why? What do you think is a potential problem, al pi din, with asking the doctors, when they're declaring somebody dead, to throw in a little scan to check if the blood flow is going to the brain? What? Well, close. Worse. Worse than nivel ames.
Because that's like a goses.
Yes. Are you allowed to touch a goses? Goses is like a flickering candle. A person who's on the brink of death, any little touching can kill them. So here's where there's a major medical debate between Rabbi Tendler, Rabbi Bleich, and others, and really Moshe Zalman and Yosha. Is there a problem with doing this scan to a goses?
Did anybody ever die from having a scan done?
I don't know. They're ended up dead anyway.
No. I mean, did their condition get any worse?
Well,
before the scan was done.
You mean a healthy person?
No. We're continuing to go.
You're never going to get the answer to that question. Can't answer that question because it's always a goses. You never know.
A goses is someone who will be infected, but you can
do the shiloh is by a goses. In other words, our shiloh is, can a nuclear scan kill a goses? That's our issue. I don't know. I think there's enough of a problem with, you got to understand, what Chazal tell me, what the Halacha tells me, I can't do to a goses. It's very minute. I can't close their eye. I can't do that. That type of touch is considered dangerous.
Chazal didn't know enough about, yeah, I'm not going to do that, but that's...
So, if I can't do that, if that might, they knew more about a goses than medical science. Ask me what medical science knows about a goses.
No, we're assuming that goses is something that if you do something to that.
Goses is a halachic category. It's a halachic category. It is the way that Levan Soloveitchik and Moshe Chaim would say those, I think their definition is best. It is the process of death, and really everybody calls it this way, has commenced. That's what a goses is. It did. The process of death. It's not over, but it's commenced. It's begun.
But the reason why, does that mean that there's no more
so
death?
Does medicine know anything about that? I don't know.
No, the reason why we can't test them is we're afraid we're going to kill them.
What yeshiva did they go to? Huh?
The reason why we can't test them is we're afraid we're going to kill them.
We can end it. Yeah.
So that's, but if we know this is not going to hurt them anyway, then we should do it.
Yeah, but you have no way of that's unknown. That's the thing we don't know.
Why can't you?
Because the only way to tell, here's how you can tell. You take, it's going to sound funny. You and I will do an experiment. We'll take 100 ghosts in, right? And we'll take 50, randomize them. 50 of them are going to get this nuclear scan, and 50 we're not going to touch at all. But somehow it's going to placebo. Right?
Yes.
And then we're going to see, all right, out of the 50 that got it, how many died, and out of the 50 that did it, they're all going to die. You know, ghosts can die at different periods of time. Right? By definition, let's say within 3 days. So it's just an impossible study to do. Right? Yeah. Because... You know, here's what Rabbi Yosha writes. I think it was Rabbi Yosha or Shlomo Zalman. Okay, right? You're going to tell me that taking some type of dye, let's assume they have the IV. First of all, if you're putting an IV in, again, if you have to put an IV in for this purpose, that's totally awesome, right? To take a ghost and put an IV in for the purpose of declaring them dead would be, I think, a chuli alma. So let's assume he has an IV. He's in the ICU, whatever, he's got an IV. So now you're just injecting him with a radioactive material. So I can't believe that type of action of injecting anything into somebody is not at least as much of a disturbance to the person's physiological equilibrium as going like this, which is us.
Yeah, but we could say if it's also this, it's not because they are like a
knife. I know, but since we have no way of proving it one way or the other, we have to assume Safik Ritzicha L'chumim. Yep.
The definition of ghosis, does that mean that he's for sure going to die? Or just that the process has begun. Like, what exactly does that mean?
The statement is
he's automatically going to die.
It's a good question. You know, the Gemara asks that question. It talks about it. Rov goes in the east. But not called.
What does that mean?
Most.
No, I know.
So some come back.
So, but is he
technically ghostless? We can't get the name. Huh?
So is that's considered a ghostless still?
A ghostless, it could be that the process of death has commenced. And either an Asiya Shemayim or a medical miracle through Shemayim, it is the same universe.
Yeah, Would we be able to say that?
So if we say that Roe were gonna die, did you say that? I didn't hear you say that. If Roe were gonna die anyway, then why can't we
end it earlier?
They can't kill
no,
them.
Not end it earlier. You don't know. It's a suffix. It's something whether he's gonna
I can't suffix end it earlier.
Is
it? Suffix Ritzicha. Suffix
Ritzicha.
Ending it earlier is
Ritzicha. Right? If I'm meant to live.
But we already said it's a suffix.
Another 5 minutes. I want my 5 minutes.
Sure. I'm not saying that I should take away that 5 minutes. However, what if it's a suffix whether or not I'm going to take away those 5 minutes?
That's
not. Like
it's not. Suffix against the conscience. You gotta realize what we're talking about. We used to go down to the same guys who can live a whole life. But we value every moment of life as infinite, so it's the same suffix as by a guy, you know, who you want to live another 70 years is by your atonement.
So, there's no point to do something like
Kal Shabbos.
But then at this point, there's no real point to do like the radioactive diet or anything because it's not.
Why are we doing it, right? So according to the Harvard criteria, we don't need to do it. Definitely don't need to. To declare death in the secular world, they don't do this. In fact, if they're not up on it, like it's not going to be a bunch of problematic. You start talking about this stuff, they look at you like you're out of your mind. Explain what this happened to me. All right, I'll end with the story and the bio thing. And then we'll pick up with, this is all the scientific background. Next week we go through the Makaros. Wednesday we'll go through the Makaros. Right, and after the Makaros, that's it. It's one Gemara, one Mishnah, basically, and we have to focus on. That's it. That's what the whole argument's about. That's it. But the story that happened to me, why this sometimes makes a difference, is what we're going to end up seeing is that I told you the Rabbanut defines death as cessation of breathing alone. That's all they're going to care about. They don't need anything else. Rabbi Tendler, B'shem Rav Moshe Feinstein, defines death as hutaz rosha, as decapitation, physiologic decapitation, which means there's no connection now between the body and the brain. There's no communication from the body to the brain. How do you prove that? So brain death alone is not going to do it, right? Because it just is a functional brain death, right? But what you need, according to the way we go l'chumra understanding hutaz rosha, what we might need is more than that. We might need a physical decapitation, right? We might need lysis of the brain stem, which means once it's dead, it liquefies, and that would be good enough to declare somebody dead according to Rabbi Tanya. How do you prove such a thing is going on without cutting the bone? See? So he determines, which is valid, that all I need to do is show no blood supply to the brain, and I've proven it. But unlike the Rabbanut doesn't need this. The Rabbanut just needs apnea test, that's it. Rabbi Tendler is going to need more. He's going to need, at least from the way he presented his shita, originally he definitely needs this. We'll see later there's a little elaboration. But in the beginning, up front, Pashat Shah in the Igros Moshe Feinstein, is you need to show somehow that there's a real physical license. So you need to have this test. So I get this call a couple of summers ago. What's unique about the summers when it comes to Rabbanim?
In the country.
Yeah.
They're away, right? All the rabbis are away. So there was this poor young rabbi. I think he was like the assistant rabbi. He's fresh out of school. You know, he barely handled a kashrus question, let alone. He gets called in. There was this family. It was unfortunately, he was a young guy, he was a teenager, who was at Columbia, who had this really tricky operation that went really well, except that mishap happened, unfortunately, really horrible. During bypass, air got into the bypass machine, which is horrible thing to happen, and it was like a major air miss to his brain, and he was brain dead. His heart was fine, right? They didn't want his heart because he had horrible heart disease. What they wanted was his liver. It was an individual in the front community who was a very, very well-known person, very beloved person, who there had been many advertisements for to get a liver. So here was this family. They wanted to give. They wanted to get some money out of their loss of their son. They wanted to get his liver to this individual that was in need. So they call in this young rookie rabbi, and they say, okay, we want to donate his liver. We want you to take care of it. So the first question is, do you accept brain death altogether? Right? So they said, we have to ask your posik, the family. It's the family's decision. So they got the posik they called as accepts. Right? I go, which sheet though? because this rabbi ended up going to me, right, to help him out. To help him out in two ways. One, the way he posed the question, he says he wants me to go in, because it was my house. So find out, they declared this kid brain dead. Did they do it in a way that satisfies Rabbi Tendler's position? Because that's the post. Rabbi Tendler, Rabbi Moshe, the Feinstein family, that is the position that they're depending on to allow for the living to be taken and to be declared dead. So I have to go in and determine, did they do it right? So A, did they do everything they're supposed to do? And B, you know, because he never trusted anybody, but B, do they satisfy that position? So I said to this young rabbi, I go, do you know what that means? Because he had no idea. He just thought brain dead is brain dead. Just make sure that he did brain dead. I said, no, there's a big difference here. If you told me it was the Rabbanut, okay, the Rabbanut, I'm sure they did. You can tell me that you want to satisfy that other sheet, though. I don't think they did an imaging. We never do an imaging in that setting. As it turned out, they did it. They hadn't done it. So now they're in the dilemma. I go back to the family and the family. And, you know, I was very unhappy to be dragged into this, but because this is not going to be pleasant, the family's dying to do this. You know, they're very anxious.
See, consider a ghost case?
Well, it depends. According to the Rabbi Israel, he's dead. According to Rabbi Tendler, he's almost dead. Maybe he's dead. He's probably dead, but we just got to get the image. According to Rav Shechter, Rabbi Yosha, Rosh Zalman, he's suffering a lot. Suffering.
So,
according to Rabbi Black, and Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, he's definitely alone.
So you got a problem.
But also for like the
liver transplant, can't you take like part of the liver transplant and not like take the whole thing?
Like
you
can
oh, so yeah, he's a ghost. In terms of that.
But what I'm saying, like,
you would kill him. So you can't just do that.
Okay.
And live liver donation, right, is a real thing. But they wanted to really go the whole way.
Why would
they wanted to give the whole liver?
But I'm saying, like, why would they have to? Why could they go halfway and then there wouldn't be a problem?
Oh, it's halfway going up for a
process. You can't cut open.
Yeah.
If he would have been alive, well, healthy person, you could have done that.
Isn't there legitimate?
You wouldn't do it. He was only like a 15-year-old boy.
But I'm saying, what, is it a halakhic problem?
To tell one of the ghosts? Yes. Because you can't touch a ghost. This is going to be. For Rav Yosha and Rav Shlomo Zalman, after they have a home, you see, they have a whole give and take.
But it's a subject.
Back to what I said. At the end of the day, if they were willing to grant them, at the end of the sheet, they said, you're stuck. You'll never be able to do this because of Moses. Moses is the killer in the end.
But is that
it's like. Just
a
Oh, we'll see that. That's really? Right. Is that true? Ritzicha is Mutter because of Kohen Nefesh. Yahweh Ba Yavo. Suffolk because Nefesh is Yarvayam. Right? In other words, you're not allowed to play Russian roulette. If I like, you know, I like, let's say, he says, I'm going to shoot you in the head if you don't shoot that guy. All right, I'm going to shoot him. They know when they do a lie, so it's okay. Yeah, Yarvayam. All right,
so what happened?
In the end, I don't like what happened.